AI data centers are highly variable. So they can jump from, 30% capacity to 100% within seconds, drop back down, go back up. We talked about having facilities the size of a small city. It's almost akin to having a city turn on and off on a regular
Right.
basis.
Welcome to the Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. I'm Francis Bradley of Electricity Canada. This is number 117, episode 117 of the Flux Capacitor. I've been chatting with the industry's business leaders, thought leaders, new market players, and stakeholders, the folks that have been pondering the future of how we create, move, trade, and use energy, and what the future changes will mean for electricity companies, regulators, society, and customers. I hope these conversations have given you, the listener, a sense of the conversations that are taking place in the sector. My guest on the podcast today is
Ahmed Rashwan, Senior Director of Transmission Planning and Operations at Electric Power Engineers.
Ahmed joined me for a conversation about EPE, Electric Power Engineers, and his focus on the challenges of integrating renewables and large loads like AI data centers, which can fluctuate rapidly, impacting grid reliability. He emphasized the need for adaptive plans and regulatory approaches. And we closed the conversation with a great book recommendation that, while ostensibly about sports, is all about leadership and culture. Here is my conversation with Ahmed Rashwan, recorded on Zoom in July 2025.
Ahmed, welcome to the podcast. Great to have a chance to chat about EPE and where you guys fit in the energy transition puzzle.
Sounds good.
So, well, why don't we start off, just for the listener, maybe a little bit about Electric Power Engineers, just some background on the company so that it puts it in the context, and then we can jump into the conversation.
Absolutely. So Electric Power Engineers was founded actually in the late 60s to serve the electric cooperative markets in Texas. And it really stayed in that format for, I'd say, about 40 years. And then as the energy transition really began to push, renewable integration was becoming, quite popular across North America. The business model shifted to being more of a, at that point, developer support model, where they were looking at helping some of the developers, do their technical analyses, build models that were required for utilities to get into that interconnection process and get through it and get connected. And then as we kind of got into the late 2010s, the utility segment of the organization, I'll talk about that a little bit more, started to grow as well. And so as of today, EPE is divided into two verticals, one that supports developers for both generation and load. And on the other side, one that supports utilities, which is the part of the organization that I work in. Which is it's maturing, but it's not as mature as our business on the other side. So today we have about 420 employees. I'd say about 350 of them are power system engineers in some aspect. And in Canada, out of the 420, we have about 140 employees across 9 provinces today.
Okay, so in 9 provinces, you started in Texas. You're now in multiple countries. I think you're probably on multiple continents as well.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. We also have resources in Panama, Dominican Republic, and Lebanon as well. So we have offshore resources there supporting our core business on a day-to-day basis.
Right. Okay. So that's a pretty high percentage of power engineers for the company, 350 out of 420. That must make for a bit of an interesting culture, I would guess, right?
Certainly. I think overall in the organization, we strive for excellence. And, you have a bunch of electrical engineers who are, a lot of them with very advanced degrees, really distinguished backgrounds coming in, really looking to serve the industry. And what I've found is that really sets the bar high on what we look to deliver to our partners in the industry. If you were to ask our clients, and I hope if it ever happens that you do, I think what distinguishes us in the industry is our dedication to quality and partnership. And it really does come through that excellence. So they see it, they feel it when they work with our team, that that bar is set high, and that they're able to kind of benefit from the excellence that we've put into the organization.
So let's talk a little bit about the sort of the place we are right now, in terms of where things stand with the evolution of the energy transition, which, and I did notice, by the way, that the tagline that the company has of "We're engineering the energy transition," which I kind of like. I think it's kind of fun and clever. But EP is looking at the challenges with respect to the energy transition writ large, what are the challenges that you're seeing, and that you see as probably maybe most consequential for your customers?
That's a great question. I think fundamentally the energy transition is a term that we use a lot, but is frankly relatively undefined. It is something that we're striving to meet certain objectives, and the path is yet to be determined, I would say. And as we kind of move ahead, trying to decarbonize to the extent that we can, but also meeting other competing objectives, such as serving artificial intelligence data centers, for example. We're talking a lot in Canada right now about expanding our industrial footprint. So, talking about additional pipelines, potentially increasing our mining capabilities. So things like that are going to require additional energy. We talk about electrification of different elements of different industries as well. So as we look to decarbonize the power system, there's also these pressures that are putting additional load on the power system. So when you look at this pragmatically, those are two competing interests almost, because there is a finite capacity of renewables that you can integrate at any given time. And there are demands that you do need to meet on a regular basis from your client base, or from your demand customers. And so with that, the energy transition as we go through it, I think is going to be adaptive. And I think that is something that we're finding with our clients. They're certainly realizing that those competing forces are things they do need to work with, and coming up with more pragmatic plans than just aspirational plans has, I think, been something that's really been a grounding force for a lot of our clients. So what we're starting to see in particular in the US is a push for potentially more gas coming online to support some of that base load that's going to be there going forward that wasn't necessarily there before. Retirements of coal facilities, certainly in Ontario, we're familiar with that. We retired coal largely in the late 2000s, early 2010s, here with the last stacks at Nanticoke coming down. And so, we transitioned to gas almost immediately. We're going to start to see some of those similar things happening in other jurisdictions, be it in Canada or be in the US, where the coal is still a primary source of fuel, and they're going to be looking for similar characteristics to support the grid.
Yeah, I mean, and I think you touched on one of the conundrums that some people see, and that is, you want to see this increasing growth of new renewables on the network, but to be able to do so, as you expand that, you often will have to expand the base load as well to be able to follow it. Now, is this sort of the space that Electric Power Engineers as a company occupies, particularly in your work now that you're working with utilities as well?
Absolutely. So today we do, and I would say we're an organization that's really focused on doing the analytical studies at this point. We also have delved into design as well, but we're really heavy on the niche kind of transmission and distribution related studies that generally are performed either at the utility level or in preparation for connection by some of the developers, kind of looking at the economics of particular interconnections, looking at some of the limitations that might be in a particular area, and potential needs to alleviate those limitations. No strategic planning. So on our end, for some of the utilities, we're looking out 20 years across a variety of different growth scenarios and identifying a spectrum of upgrades that could be required to serve different needs, and helping them identify that, I wouldn't call it a middle path, but at least a path that helps them be flexible in making decisions going forward, understanding that potential spectrum of futures that they're working in. So I'd say overall, EPE, from a work product perspective, we do a lot of really, I'd call them advanced studies, to help utilities make effective decisions, help developers make effective decisions. Like I'd mentioned, we've delved into the economic assessment side of things as well. So we have a market design as well as a economic analysis team
Okay.
that supports utilities, ISOs, RTOs, with some items around that. And also on the design side, we've started to get into facility design. Just given that you're supporting them with interconnection, you can also support them with that kind of preliminary design as they look to submit their applications. So really, we're trying to push things forward in the industry. We've been a big part of, some of the larger procurement clusters in Canada and in the US recently, representing a good proportion of the applications that have gone through, just showing the trust that we've built with I think a pretty broad client base.
Okay. I want to circle back to a couple of those things, but before I do that, I will often ask people that come on the podcast about their journey. Always interested in people's journey. So what was your journey? Is the your role today when you were a kid on the playground, did you always dream of working for a company like Electric Power Engineers and doing this kind of work? What was that journey that you went through to get to this point?
Well, I'll tell you, funny enough, I'm a fourth generation electrical engineer.
Fourth
So,
generation electrical
fourth
engineer.
generation electrical engineer. So, my grandfather, my great grandfather was an electrical engineer. My grandfather actually taught at the University of Cairo and for the UN. He was doing biomedical engineering, which is kind of a subset of electrical engineering. And he opened up a whole bunch of faculties internationally for biomedical engineering. And he actually did some sabbaticals here in Waterloo to come visit
Wow.
The family. And then, my father and my mother are both electrical engineers. So I would say I probably had my decisions made for me relatively early on, whether consciously or subconsciously. So I went to the University of Toronto, graduated from electrical engineering, and I did my professional experience here at Ontario Power Generation. And that
Okay.
was kind of my first foray into understanding the power systems. And
Right.
it was related to portfolio optimization, kind of, making sure that their assets are used in a way that returns maximum revenue for the organization. So you got into markets, you got into the physical side of operations, and that was really, I think, captivating for me. I wasn't sure which space I wanted to go into at the time, and I think that was a really helpful experience to help me, I'd say, largely decide that that was where I wanted to go.
Right.
After graduation, I joined a control systems company just to see if there was something there. It wasn't my passion. So I went back into the power system, enjoyed the Ontario IESO, where I spent 15 years actually
Oh, really?
working in
Oh, okay. Yep.
operations planning, interconnection, long-term planning, and market design. So got a chance to work in a variety of different parts of the power system industry. Really enjoyed the time there. Got a lot of experiences, made, I'd say, lifelong connections. Definitely. And since then, made the decision, and it was certainly a tough one to leave the ISO and join Electric Power Engineers 2.5 years ago. Really motivated to see, what the rest of the industry was doing, across the continent and internationally, and be part of kind of the broader changes that were happening in the industry, and also bringing some of that service back to Canada. So, I've certainly been motivated, and EPE is very supportive of this, of us growing our footprint and supporting the Canadian utilities. There's a lot that's happening, I'd say, south of the border and internationally in Europe as well, that are really great learnings for us. We can take some of those notes down and, bring those approaches back to Canada to help us kind of expedite some of the things that we're trying to do, in our own jurisdiction.
Yeah, and I've often found that, talking to people who work in firms that have a larger geographical footprint, the ability to draw upon learnings in other jurisdictions that are not anecdotal, they're actually, well, I speak to my colleague who is actually, in that space, is certainly important. Listen, I think you're the first fourth generation electrical engineer I have ever encountered. That's quite a feat. It's to any more than that, to be a fifth generation, you'd have to be related to Thomas Edison or something. But listen, I've had to ask the obvious question. Do you have kids, and are they going to be electrical engineers?
So I have two young boys, and I don't know if you've ever seen this. I think there was a Dilbert short story or something where a mother brings her child in and says they have the knack, and then he says, "I'm sorry, ma'am, your son's going to be an engineer." And so certainly I feel like my oldest one has the knack.
Oh boy.
He's very interested in all things tech. Likes to get his hands involved in, like, anything in front of him, he wants to get in there and learn about it, feel things out, understand their function. So very interested in all of that. My youngest one, we'll see. He's still 6 years old. He seems to be interested in a lot of different things. So we'll see where his path goes. But I do believe that my oldest one is going to end up as some kind of an engineer.
Wow, that'd be something if you
Yeah.
go five generations out. So listen, earlier you were talking about when working with clients, part of the challenge is looking at the different and the variety of different growth scenarios and that kind of spectrum of futures. It occurs to me that when one is attempting to predict what the future is going to look like, that spectrum gets wider and wider the further away you get from today. How challenging is it to be able to work in this space when the future is so uncertain?
It certainly is
I know it's a bit of a
challenging.
f philosophical question for somebody who's an engineer, but it's got to be a challenge, right?
And it is because, regulators and even utility leadership is looking for certainty in their decisions. And what we're trying to chart is a potential set of futures. And so, how do you work into some certainty? So what we've tried to do is identify, optionality in the plans that lead up to those different futures and see how many they cover. And have a work back plan on decisions. So let's say that, you need to make this decision by this date if you want to cover these futures. Here are some upgrades that you could potentially, prepare to be scaled up in the future should those situations arise. If not, you'll still have the upgrades in place that you need in the near term. So there are some things that are, I'd say, I wouldn't say relatively common practice, but, utility practice where they can stage things in. And that's certainly something we've been advocating for, and even some more creative ways of doing that. So I think it is translating that philosophical, looking at, the variety of futures into a pragmatic plan of what could we do with these set of futures and turn into a plan for utilities to approve or follow.
And so, as you begin to look further ahead in these futures, what are the things that kind of give you pause, or what are the biggest concerns, the areas of uncertainty that kind of creep into this?
Yeah, I'd say more recently and really impactful are the large loads that we're seeing come onto the system or apply to come onto the system. Some of the data centers that we're seeing in Canada and in the US, their load is the size of a small city. And when you look at these in aggregate, and we just did a clustering analysis of, multiple loads connecting in one jurisdiction, it amounted to 20 gigawatts in one cluster study. It's essentially reforming the entire power system in that area. And so when you look at lumpy changes like that, it does become a little challenging because if those don't come in, your chances of stranded assets become, much higher. And so there needs to be dialogue, and there is dialogue today to help, I guess, manage some of that risk with the load centers that are looking to connect and saying, look, this is going to be a shared risk arrangement. If you're going to connect, we're going to have a take or pay agreement. This was one of them was just approved in by the PUC of Ohio to say, look, if data centers are going to connect in our state, they're going to have to pay up to 85% of what they applied for. So whether you use that load or not, you're going to pay for it to help kind of curb that risk. So we're seeing
And is that
opportunities.
is there is there an openness on the kind of the other side of the table to those kinds of arrangements?
I think there's an understanding that it's going to be necessary. The utilities have to recover their costs. And, there's other jurisdictions that have done similar things in the US. And it's an emerging theme of, it's almost a different tariff for those particular load categories, given, the amount of infrastructure investment required.
Right.
Typically, utilities welcome load, and they don't look to have any special treatment for them because it's rate base. But in this case, it's so impactful that they need to look at it from a different regulatory lens than they normally would.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like these are going to require regulatory approaches that will be new and unique that we've never tried before. So how much of the conversations that you're in are now starting to spill over into conversations now about unique and different regulatory approaches?
That's certainly something that we are starting to be involved in. I know we've had people at EPE who've been at FERC meetings and who've had to provide expert witness testimony on varying items. And it's an area that we see certainly growing as these types of arrangements come through. I'm certain that our developer side of the company will be supporting some of the developer community, and we'll certainly be supporting some of the utilities just on navigating this. One thing I would share, Francis, is there's a lot of really good work happening on the large load front because, from a technical perspective, they present unique challenges. And from a regulatory perspective, they present unique challenges. And what I've been encouraged by is in some of the forums, including I'm leading some work right now with Energy Systems Integration Group around establishing performance requirements for these loads. The collaboration that we're seeing between the load community and the utilities has been encouraging.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'd be very concerned about that.
Absolutely. I think they've rallied around the idea. And I was speaking at a panel last week at the Texas Reliability Entity, and Jim Robb, who's the CEO of NERC, was there, and he gave the initial kind of welcoming message. And he noted that the White House has explicitly said that data centers are a matter of national security. That's their perspective. And so the expectation is everyone works well together to kind of make sure these connect in a way that's reliable, but also supports the AI race and that being successful kind of in the United States as well as in Canada. So definitely it's an interesting time. But integrating the facilities and they do have a really different operating philosophy. As of today, they don't have any requirements put onto them. So they're behaving in ways that we're not really expecting from a utility perspective. And I'm certainly able to dive into that a little bit more if you'd like. And those are some things we're looking to tackle as an industry.
Maybe unpack that a little bit.
Absolutely. So what we've found, and I'm going to focus on AI data centers, but I think there are different challenges that come with different facilities, and that could include crypto mining, and hydrogen facilities as well. What I would say is AI data centers are highly variable, so they can jump from 30% capacity to 8 to 100% within seconds, drop back down, go back up. It depends on the training that they're doing. So we talked about having facilities the size of a small city. It's almost akin to having a city turn on and off on a regular basis, which is
That's not good for grid reliability.
absolutely. It presents layers of challenges, and we've been talking about this, whether it's voltage control, frequency control, whether it's predictive algorithms that are not programmed to think of load disappearing and coming back online. Another challenge we've seen is some of this IT-based infrastructure is not designed to ride through kind of the normal disturbances we expect to see on the system.
Just in
So there
terms
have
of
been instances.
variability of
That's correct. So if there's a lightning strike nearby, generally and if it's not, where you're connected, we expect loads to stay online. And we study the system that way. What we've found based on, some evidence, based on particular events that happened, is in many cases, these facilities are disconnecting. And so, when you run your analyses, you're expecting particular things to happen, and then things are different. That can exacerbate, issues on the system. And you think of someone in an operating chair, they on a daily basis are operating in a way that protects the system. It's called N minus one, which is I'm always ready for the next contingency, the next event. And the predictive modeling is based on load sticking around, but in many cases they come off. And that changes how you prepare for operations, how you prepare for planning.
So
So we're
it changes just the basic concept of what N minus one can look like.
absolutely, absolutely.
Right.
So you're preparing to say, okay, I expect after this particular event happens that this is what the system looks like. But all of a sudden, all this load has come off that's the size of two or three cities. That completely changes your readiness. You could result in thermal overloads or instability in the system because of that. So these are some things we're looking to tackle as an industry as we integrate these new facilities. And as I mentioned, I mean, I've been in contact with some of the larger, Magnificent Seven type companies, and they're very collaborative. So I'm really encouraged by that.
Yeah, well, I would imagine it is in their self-interest as well now to be able to ensure some level of reliability over the long term.
Yeah, ab absolutely. I think they're motivated to connect, but they're not interested in being, the triggers for any reliability issues on the system.
Yeah. Listen, one of the things that I ask everybody that comes on the podcast, it's how we wrap up the conversation, is for a book recommendation. And so, Ahmed, I'd be really interested to hear what book you're going to tell us that we should add to our reading list. We've put them all together on our Flux Capacitor book club. So what book should we be adding to our reading list today?
So I'm a big basketball fan. So I'm going to tie one in that's related to leadership and basketball together. It's 11 Rings by Phil Jackson. The book covers, I guess parallels between coaching a high-performing basketball team and just general leadership principles that are translatable into the business world. And I mean, there's a couple of things I can highlight from there that stuck with me is he talks a lot about authentic leadership and leading with passion. That's something that I think is really important, in particular as we get into different generations of workforce. I think that's becoming a priority to say, like, I'm going to be myself, and no one is better at being me than me. That's been coming out quite a bit in some of the discussions I've been having with our team. It talks about empowering people to succeed, not necessarily giving them fixed direction. And I think, that's great. So I think if anyone knows basketball, Phil Jackson put in this triangle offense, but he let them do what they want within that offensive scheme. And so it really was about that, setting the course, but then letting them work within it. Another principle mentioned was mindfulness, making sure that you're focused on what's happening now, not always focusing on the future. I talk to some of the leaders on my team on a regular basis and mention the most important thing is for you to know what's the most important thing. Really focus on what you need to be working on, and paying attention to. And lastly, and this resonates big time with me, is ensuring there's empathy in your leadership. We live in a complex world. People are dealing with different challenges, and just understanding in leadership, just being understanding and empathetic towards people, being motivated by supporting them for their success, I think is really big. And I think the objective overall, and I think in this book he mentions as well, Francis, is there is a story of a samurai. He gives each one of his kids, got three kids, a wooden arrow, and he asks them to break it. And they can each break the wooden arrow, no problem. And then he says, okay, here's all three arrows together. Try to break it. Weren't able to break it. So he's like, your strength is from you all being together. The teams generally want to be more than the sum of the parts. And that's really what we're at EPA, I'd say, motivated as a whole, as an organization, is trying to build communities within the company to really build that team spirit environment, despite being a largely remote organization. So, an area of focus for us.
Well, hey, I'm not a big basketball fan or anything. But I am going to get this book. This sounds really interesting. So we will add to our reading list, 11 Rings, The Soul of Success by Phil Jackson with Hugh Delahanty. It says here on the internet, and we will include a link to it on the show page for the podcast. Ahmed, thank you very much for not only giving us a really good suggestion here for an addition to the book club, but also for a really interesting conversation. Thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, friends. I appreciate it.
For those that have been with the podcast since the beginning and those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. Tune in for future episodes. And please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen and let me know what you think of the Flux Capacitor. You can find me through our website at electricity.ca, on LinkedIn, and on Instagram as the Brad Bradley. The website for this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca, and it includes links for this episode on the show page, this being episode 117. And while you're there, check out the book club page, which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including Ahmed's recommendation, 11 Rings, The Soul of Success, by Phil Jackson and Hugh Delahanty. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.